Welcome to That's a Wrap, episode number one, a podcast about film, media, and culture. I'm Eric Marshall. You can find me at ericmarshall.net. We also have with us Chris Gullin.
Yeah, you can find me at www.chrisgullin.com.
And Nick Schlegel.
Yes, and I maintain an online academic presence at nick.gstreetmedia.com.
We are all professors of cinema studies at different colleges and universities. We all have PhDs in film and media studies. And today, in the main segment, which we call Principal Photography, we will be talking about The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and in segment two, The Legacy of Roger Ebert, who just passed last week. We picked Perks of Being a Wallflower because it's Nick's favorite film of 2012. So we're going to have him bring the case for the film, and then we're going to have a discussion about that. Perks of Being a Wallflower was directed by Stephen Chbosky, who also wrote the novel on which it's based. It came out last year, and I'm sure a lot of you saw it. And I'm just going to jump right to Nick. So, Nick, what did you like about this film?
Well, it's pretty rare that I have a profound cinematic experience. And for me, it's probably happened maybe a dozen, 15 life tops. And I'm talking about just an unbelievable connection between the apparatus of cinema and myself as a spectator, where I become so engrossed in the film and threaded into it that I have almost like a don't know where the film starts and I stop type of a reaction. In fact, I thought I'd just start off by reading a Facebook post that I actually put on there shortly after I saw the film. As an aside, I should mention that I watched this film in my friend Don May Jr.'s basement. Don's president of Synapse Films, a boutique distribution label who will, I'm sure, have on the show at some point in the near future. And Don has, a lot invested in his home theater. So it was very much a cinematic experience. So I just thought I'd preface it by saying that. At any rate, on Facebook, what I wrote was, quote, I quoted myself, I said, "It's rare that a film has a terribly profound effect on me. The Perks of Being a Wallflower, however, did just that. A brief analog. I first heard David Bowie's Heroes when he performed it at Live Aid in 1985. Within a few days, I made it to Solo Records and bought Bowie's Transcendent Heroes. And over time, I wore the magic contained in that wax groove completely down. During my 20s, seeking tenure as a fledgling screenwriter, I often mentally edited that song and its majesty into every dramatic or cinematic scene or sequence or montage or languid crane shot as I pictured end credits rolling and perhaps my career blossoming and eventually flourishing. Well, as I personally never got around to it, I waited patiently for a filmmaker to pick up the torch that I left back in my 20s and bring Heroes into a film as I had always imagined and intended it, as integral to the story in some way. The Perks of Being a Wallflower, along with dozens of other magical and amazing things, did just that. It's a magical film, particularly for those of us who were of high school age in the late 80s or 90s. I'm in love with it, it speaks to me, and it's my pick for Best Picture. Of course, it wasn't nominated for anything. The Academy overlooked it. But I want to build off of that comment right there. So clearly, people listening to this will see that I was really enraptured with this film. And I think, first and foremost, that's because I thought the cast was incredible. For me, the casting was so spot on. I mean, after all, Chbosky wrote the novel, he wrote the screenplay, and he directed it. So clearly, he could just pick the character when they walked into the room because he'd lived with them for so long. So in terms of like spot on casting, the film was, represents what I consider to be sort of like, a pinnacle of accuracy between what the author originally intended or imagined and what ultimately was cast in the film. Secondly, it speaks to me because it's sort of the epic year in the life of this young man, sort of a portrait of him as a young artist, which is very much highlighted in his first day of school, of high school as a freshman, in his English class in The Last Hour, which Paul Rudd plays as this real formative English teacher in Charlie's young life. And surrounding him in the classroom are all the great authors, embedded into the mise-en-scene of the film. You see, Oscar Wilde in the background and Tolstoy and so on and so forth, all these familiar faces. And then, of course, above Paul Rudd on the chalkboard, the writing process is there behind him, and it's a banner that actually reads pre-write, compose, evaluate, revise, which of course is, you know, can be read as a larger commentary about literature writing, screenplay writing, the whole nine yards. And so just sort of based upon those first things, sort of like, you know, a teenage film about a portrait of a young artist, angsty, already sort of like coming together, I was immediately taken by it. So that was, you know, I'll start off by saying that, and then I've obviously many other things to say, but we can get some feedback from you guys just about sort of the setup of the film and how it appealed to you.
What'd you think, Chris?
I have to agree with Nick. I think every generation has its own coming of age film, and you know films like Stand By Me, which are these strong coming of age type films. I think Perks of Being a Wallflower would have to be included within that canon. The casting was spot on. I have to agree with Nick that I don't think that that it was really done justice. The only award nomination it got was a Writers Guild of America Best Adapted nomination. I think that it certainly was overlooked by pretty much the everyone, Academy, Golden Globes. All of that, but I had very little quibbles with the film, very very little things, but I thought it was overall great. I like the fact that it really tapped into a soundtrack that was current for the period, and wasn't I guess, for lack of a better term, it wasn't kind of this hipster soundtrack that kind of has been become very popular over the past few years. So I'd like that especially, and the fact that it had a nice score. So that last scene, the music that they used, that last scene, it really was reminiscent of the opening to U2's "Where the Streets Have No Name." So that added kind of a layer of context. Right,
yeah, I liked it too. I saw it on Nick's insistence. It was on my list, but I moved it way up because Nick wanted me to see it. I have some quibbles with it as well, but I'm going to save those for a little bit later. We should probably tell everybody listening to this that there will be spoilers. We're just going to assume that you've seen the film. If you haven't, press pause, go watch it, and come back because we will spoil the film. And I just thought we should warn you about that. But I enjoyed the film as well, with a few reservations. I enjoyed it. I thought it was well done, and I agree with you, Nick, that the fact that the novel writer directed it, I think, adds, I don't know, some credence to it, I guess, in the sense that we can be fairly sure that it's the same vision. But, I mean, as an adaptation, I haven't read the novel, so I don't know what kind of differences there are. And I guess it doesn't really matter too much. But I think it captures the period really well. I think it, and as far as, like you said, a coming of age, I think that you hit the nail on the head with the coming of age, Chris, that it hits that pretty well as well.
Yeah. I did insist. My friends know me, know that, like, I become a very fervent advocate for films and television shows that I think are, you know, many cuts above the sort of slag heap of mediocrity out there. And I felt that Perks of Being a Wallflower was way, way above. You know, it's like Chris mentioned, it's clearly up there with films like Stand By Me or Breakfast Club or Breaking Away. It's very much a generational film. And I feel it will be looked back. It's already a cult book. The book has achieved a cult status. And I feel the film, because of its, I don't want to say marginalization, but because of its sort of like its lack of proper dissemination, let's call it that, and lack of real attention, it will also find a cult audience, much in the same way, say, like Dazed and Confused has, or Before Sunrise and so on. I've got a laundry list of things I want to talk about this film that I hopefully the listeners will also find really fascinating about it. And that really leads me into sort of like a subtle theoretical lens that I'd like to apply to the film by bringing in Umberto Eco's famous essay about Casablanca and its status as a cult movie. And I just want to read to you some things that Echo writes about Casablanca in relate, because I think there's a very strong connection between what he says about that and Perks. And Echo writes, "I think that in order to transform a work into a cult object, one must be able to break, dislocate, unhinge it so that one can remember only parts of it, irrespective of their original relationship with the whole. In the case of a book, one can unhinge it, so to speak, physically, reducing it to a series of excerpts. A movie, on the contrary, must be already ramshackle, rickety, unhinged in itself. A perfect movie, since it cannot be reread every time we want, from the point we choose, as happens with the book, remains in our memory as a whole." And then he goes on to talk about, he even talks about Rocky Horror Picture Show and stuff like that. But I guess what the point I'm trying to make here is that when he says that you can dislocate an unhinge a film and sort of rearrange them in the order, the scenes that you want to, and he goes on to talk about the magic frame, basically, in relationship to Casablanca. For me, Chbosky has written so many perfect moments in this film, starting with, you could start it right from when he decides to go talk to Patrick at the football game. You know, he sits down in the front bleachers all by himself, but yet he decides to muster up the courage to go talk to this guy that was making fun of Tom Savini in shop class because he thinks he's clever and funny. He's a senior. And he goes and talks to him. He comes away from the wall at the dance to Dexy Midnight Runners to go dance with Sam and Patrick. The spin the bottle scene, scene that's so pivotal in the film. And all these other little magic moments in the film, to me, sort of give it this sort of like cult status in that I can watch sections of it, unhinge the film, and yet it all works completely stylistically, holistically.
I don't know about the cult status. I mean, is that something, and you know maybe better than I do on this, but is that something that time has to tell for something to be a cult movie?
Well, that's why I've prefaced it by saying that it's already achieved status as a cult book. So it's like, now obviously we're talking about two different mediums, but the writer of the book has adapted, you know, the material from one medium to another. And I'm not saying that a film has achieved cult status. I'm saying that Echo says that when a film does achieve cult status, one of his prerequisites is that you can dislocate the film into different series of things, like, you know, mm-hmm. Play It Again, Sam, and like, right. Which didn't actually happen, or We'll Always Have Paris, right. Yeah. Or this looks like the beginning of these special magic frames. And to me, Perks is just like overflowing with these magic scenes and magic frames.
Well, I think the fact that they embed probably the most well-known, one of the most well-known cult films of all time, Rocky Horror Picture Show, within this film, it kind of lends itself to, you know,
a cult film by including a cult film? I mean, is it trying to ride in the coattails of Rocky Horror Picture Show?
No, I think the subtext of Rocky Horror is sort of embedded into the tapestry of the themes mm-hmm. of the film, which is don't dream it, be it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so instead of like being the wallflower, he actually starts living his life. I mean, that's a scene that's recreated in the movie theater. The don't dream it, be it scene is a very big part of it. So I think, you know, it's a cult book with a cult movie in it that may achieve cult status one day, actually. So, I don't think there's any accident that Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is a film that so many of us, little enclaves or social castes in high school definitely latched onto in high school and went to.
Yeah, I agree that that's the strength of the movie, is catching that. Some of the social groups and how you know one tries to fit in as a freshman or a sophomore and how difficult that can be. But what do you think, like you say, a cult movie, according to Echo, you can take it apart and it's quotable. What quotes come to you from this film?
Well, for me, it's not exactly just quotes. It's the actual sort of, I guess what you could say is, for me, and this is a criteria that I use in my assessment of most films on a personal level, not on a critical or academic level, but on a personal level, is the film breathes. In other words, the director, in this case the screenwriter and author of the book, has let the film be film. It just breathes. It has a respiration to it that is soothing and calming. And so when I look at these particular scenes and I like to rewatch them, I get very emotional with them. And I should share with you that the director's absolute favorite scene in the film just happened to be my favorite scene too, which was one I didn't know it was his favorite until I listened to the audio commentary. More about that in a minute. But it happens to be the first kiss scene. In which, you know, Sam and Charlie are in Sam's bedroom with a wonderful job. One wonderful job the production designer and art director did in creating that room. And that scene plays on for a little bit. It's at this Christmas party where they've all been like secret Santas to each other. And they're, you know, she's asking him about whether or not he's had been, you know, girlfriends. And it all gets down, well, have you even kissed a girl? And the answer is no. And then in this incredibly touching and beautiful scene, which worthy of cult worship in my mind, she ultimately says, you know, I just want to make sure that the first person that kisses you loves you. And then, of course, she, you know, she kisses him. And I have to tell you, you know, I welled up in Don's basement watching that scene because it was... for me, it was really just about simple human kindness between two people, and how that one special moment could create a lifetime's worth of memories. I mean, talk about a memorable first kiss, and that her character, who has been abused and has such a sweet and innocent guile about her, that she would be so giving of herself in that moment and says, "I want to make sure that the first person that kisses you loves you." That's special. It's just special. Of course, there's many other scenes like that in the film for me. Clearly, the Bowie stuff is phenomenal. But and then there's, you know, there's the one portion we need to talk about later is clearly the Return of the Repressed, the trigger, the sex that he has with Sam that brings back all of his repressed memories, his black spots, and he has, you know, a very severe anxiety attack, which was, you know, really profound. But I'll give it up to you guys for a minute here.
Well, a couple things. The first thing I just wanted to say was, like I said, I haven't read the book either, but does he actually have sex with Sam? Because it seemed to me the way the film, the implications are that he recoils when she touches his thigh, which, in, you know, obviously that's a gesture to the fact that he was abused by his aunt, and it's laid out.
They, you know, I mean, it's the next morning, and in the audio commentary, it's
I didn't see the audio commentary. I'll defer to
There is that. I mean, what you're talking about are those repressed memories and everything. I found that to be really well done in this film, actually, because there is a long time that you're wondering what are these memories, what's going on here, right? And there's a part of me that, like, even probably two-thirds of the film, I'm not sure they're going to reveal it, you know. And when it gets revealed, I think it's done in a really powerful way, and I think it's really well done. I'd kind of forgotten about that. Maybe I repressed it, but but I think that's well done. The connection to sex, though, is kind of interesting, right? Is this like, so is him having sex, or, you know, even if you want to take sex out of it, establishing this relationship with this girl, is that supposed to be freeing? Is that something that releases the repressed memories? So is,
yeah,
that kind
I view
of the
it as
answer?
A trigger.
Yeah,
kind it's of, definitely a trigger. Yeah. The way it's shot, you know, the minute, I mean, it's a parallel cut between her hand and his thigh and his aunt's hand. And so it acts as a trigger. And, of course, the next morning after she goes away, as he has this severe and powerful anxiety attack the way home, and all of the black spots from the film, him kicking the shit out of those three, you know, bullies, Brad's football team member friends, and every other little black spot that's been sort of hinted at, comes to the fore, and it's brilliantly cut against the images of him as a child with his aunt. You know, it'll be our little secret, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, it triggered within myself very strong memories of, you know, childhood trauma that I had. I know what it's like to have a cop come to the door of your home and tell you, you know, really bad news. And of course, this happens twice in this sequence. Once when the door answers, they answer the door, and there's a cop there to say that she's been killed, you know, smashed by this car. And of course, the cops break in at the end of the sequence to ostensibly save Charlie from committing suicide after he calls his sister, which is a really touching scene too.
Yeah, I agree.
So it's just really powerful. You know, suicide looms quietly in the background. You don't really know what's going to happen. And I guess, you know, the magic moments that I find in this film, I find very similar to my own. You know, there's this whole big New Year's Eve party where he's tripped and he's gone out and he's doing snow angels. But prior to that, Sam comes out to him as in the early parts of the trip. And I had a very similar New Year's Eve experience one time. And although I didn't have the first girl that kissed me, in fact, the first girl that kissed me, I was in second grade. I think I like bopped her over the head with my Scooby-Doo lunchbox, which is a famous story in my house. But you know, I didn't have the kindness of a Sam in that scene. But I will say that in the audio commentary, Chbosky says that not only is that his favorite scene, but it and I'm quoting him here, he says it's the perfect expression of what he wanted to say as a novelist, a person, and a filmmaker, and he could not be prouder of 3.5 minutes of film.
Okay.
And I'd go on to say that I would have that Chbosky's audio commentary is probably one of the most magnanimous and informative and entertaining and deeply personal commentaries I've ever heard in my entire life.
Which is interesting, because this was the first film that he ever directed.
He's got another one in him.
Is that right? Is that right? The first? I didn't even know.
Yeah, it's the first film he directed. But he's written for Jericho, the TV series. He wrote a lot of that. He wrote the screenplay for Rent.
Yeah.
Oh, but this is the first thing he's directed.
Wow, yeah. Chris and I are huge Rent fans.
Yeah.
I don't know where you stand on Rent, Eric.
I'm neutral on Rent, but yeah, it makes you wonder if he's got another one in him or if this was it, right? You know, but I for me, director's commentary, it can be hit or miss, right? Because a lot of directors do not know how to talk about their work. And the little snippet that we, some of the audio commentary that we listened to earlier, really, I think, I agree with you. He's a very articulate man. You would think so for a novelist, but...
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a good point. Whether he's got another one in him. I mean, this film could have gone either way. It could have been either really good like it was, or it could have been a real bomb because of the fact that you had somebody who was very, very close to their you know, the work, the material, directing for the first time. I've seen other films that were you had somebody who was very close to a film and it was directed by not necessarily the writer, but the film that immediately comes to my head was the film adaptation of The Producers with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane. It was directed by the choreographer who didn't have any experience in film directing, and it just didn't go over well in certain scenes. So I think that Chbosky did as a really
I couldn't agree more.
Job with
yeah, I mean, this is a guy that seems to instinctively know how to translate one medium to another, which is obviously a very difficult task. So he translated the essence of the book over to a completely different medium and did it beautifully. And, you know, I've been trying to make a case throughout this. You know, I know you guys both enjoyed it very much. I think one thing that can't be underestimated, I think, is Paul Rudd. I mean... back it up a second, you know, like Joan Cusack and Paul Rudd they worked for scale on this, and they worked for a day. And Paul Rudd, his character in this is so likable, but he has the linchpin of the whole film. You know, when he tells Charlie, "We accept the love we think we deserve," seems to be one of the major themes that runs throughout the film, and it's so poignant that it's coming from this early mentor in his life.
Yeah.
You know, and I love the literary sort of, you know, milieu that this entire film is cast in, the typewriter itself. I know Eric, you just got an old typewriter, so I know that must have hit a chord with you when he's, you know, when Sam types on the typewriter, she gives it to him for Christmas, "Write about us," and then he writes, "I will."
Mm-hmm.
It's so touching. Yeah. That's one of those magic frames I'm talking about, guys.
That makes me wonder, like, why is he turning all his papers into his teacher handwritten? Why didn't he type them in that nice typewriter?
He hadn't gotten most of them yet. You know, that was a Christmas present.
But this is
maybe he saved that for his own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. This is where I have to depart from you guys a little bit on the direction. I think it's a well-written film. I haven't read the novel. I think it's a well-written film. And visually, I think it really works. And I agree with you about Paul Rudd in the terms of when he says, you know, what was the quote?
We accept the love we think we deserve.
Yeah, we accept the love we think we deserve. I think that's a great quote, and it really wraps up a lot of the themes of the film. And I even forgive it for telling us, because I think it works as a quote, and he brings it back later.
Because he's telling it to a kid.
Right. But the thing that bothered me in this film was, I think it does have to do with him being a first-time director, is that the performances were a little over the top. It suffers from that kind of movie high school kind of syndrome. You know, these are not high school kids. Nobody acts like these people acted. The gay character is too flamboyantly gay. The jocks are too jockey. Nobody's like that, you know? And that was one of the problems I had. I was like, these are movie high schoolers. These are movie gay people. These are movie theater nerds, right? Now, that said, I totally identified with it, and I totally got what was going on, and I forgive it that for the most part. And there was one point where I was like, when Paul Rudd was, and Paul Rudd is like a high school, is a movie teacher, you know, walking around the room and, you know, happening to see what's written on the kid's notebook and taking him on as a mentor. It was so like, I mean, Dead Poet Society, right? And there was a point where I was like, if I see Catcher in the Rye, I'm going to turn this movie off. But, and you do see it, but he doesn't talk about it. So it's okay, because I was about to be like, I'm done if he starts talking about Catcher in the Rye. So that's all I have to say.
I would agree with you 100%, Eric. I would just say that I don't find them as flaws. You're dealing with archetypes in a film like this, obviously. I mean, take away that from Stand By Me or The Breakfast Club or Dead Poets, which were all hugely successful. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because in the audio commentary, Chbosky says that Breakfast Club is his favorite, you know, high school film, and followed very closely by Dead Poets, which I think maybe even said that Dead Poets replaced Breakfast Club. I think using archetypes to bring us into this world, this character study of Charlie, is fair. Most of the people in the film are archetypes, but I think the casting of these particular actors brings them to life and makes them sing in a register higher than in your traditional archetype that sort of degrades down to stereotypical. Your points are all valid, and I agree with them. I just say that for me, it wasn't a big deal, because ultimately I cared so much about Charlie that none of that shit really mattered.
And I agree with you on that. Yeah, I agree with you that the characters that get drawn out are drawn out well enough
to overcome the archetype
that
issue.
Overcomes it.
So we're in agreement on that. If I was, you know, going to say something, I would say, yep, I'm with you on that. It's just that it's like when, in this case, it's when somebody's arguing about sort of like narrative causality, and I go, you know, that's not really important to this film or something like that. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel that these archetypes, while you're absolutely right, just didn't bother me. It kind of like, I saw past it.
I concur. I think Eric brings up a really good point. The acting is at times hyperbolic. I don't know if I would completely agree that narrative causality is
let me qualify that. I say narrative causality and like La Ventura or something like that. When a student says, like, you know, wait a minute, it's not really the point of the film. So if like somebody said to me that a song that was in this film didn't come out until a year after 1991 or so, right. So, you know, that's not really what the film's about. Yeah, so narrative causality to me,
not for this movie.
That's true. That would be kind of a bullshit quibble with the film. The one, you know, quibble I had with the film was, and it seems to set Charlie's character motivations in motion, happens fairly early on when he blurts out the fact that his best friend committed suicide, and Sam runs into the room and you know, she acts shocked, and they have this opportunity, but then they drop it. They never address it for the rest of the film, and instead they shift. It seems to almost shift from him talking about his best friend's suicide. He mentions it to Sam, and then it just shifts to his aunt. And I think that they just, that whole blip could have been completely omitted. Maybe if he had said something to the effect of, instead of "my best friend committed suicide, you know, my aunt just died," or "my aunt was just killed horrifically," or something of that nature. They brought it up and they didn't do anything with it. And I didn't like that.
I don't really have a response to that. I think that's a very valid point. I would say that I could probably possibly explain it in a couple of different ways. One, it sets up the specter of suicide, which will then run as an undercurrent throughout the film, leading up to when Charlie looks at this knife at the end of the film and you don't know whether he's going to kill himself or not. You know, so like the specter of suicide is there, very present in the film and not specifically explicitly addressed. It's sort of running in the background. And there was a second thing I was going to say about that, and what was the other point you made? Was it just about that? I can't remember.
That was my point. They could have done without it. And I think that when he glances at the knife, he has been, let's accept that he does have sex with Sam. He's thrown into enough of an emotional breakdown where we see what's going to happen. We see as he's moving throughout the house. It's almost, people were expecting that he's going to look at a knife and say,
I know what I was going to say. That also, speaking of narrative causality, the scene where you're talking about when Sam comes up to him and says, goes to Patrick and says, Charlie's best friend just killed himself. It gives them a reason to sort of take him under their wing.
Yeah.
I mean, from a narrative standpoint, it gives them causality to do that. Secondly, don't forget the expert editing in that sequence during his anxiety attack or his panic attack. He enters the kitchen, and as he's entering the kitchen, we cut back to him as a little boy entering the kitchen, walking up to his aunt, and you can see the scars on her wrist when she tried to kill herself because she was a victim of childhood sex abuse. I think it's very well thought out, guys. I think that there's a lot going on here that maybe repeated viewings will reveal.
Do you think we should give Nick the last word on that and move on to Roger Ebert, or is there more?
I have nothing else to say other than the fact that I was also brought into this film by Nick. It was on my to watch list, but Nick insisted that I watch it just like Eric but I'm glad you did, because it was an absolutely wonderful film. It was profound. I love it. And like I said, my quibbles with it are very, very small. I think that it was completely overlooked by the Academy, and they just did another wonderful job with it. And I'll be curious to see what other things he was watching.
He talked about magic. I mean, that was the phrase you used, magic. And
I guess it was magical.
I'll pay it forward to my buddy Don May. Don is the one that talked me into it, oddly enough, because his friend Tom Savini, the makeup legend, special effects legend, and now mostly actor, Tom's in the film. He's Pittsburgh. It's a Pittsburgh film. And they cast him in the role as a shop teacher. And Tom was really wonderful in the role, too. So I wanted to pay it forward and thank Don for introducing me to this film. I knew of it, and it was on my list, too. But Don and I sat transfixed. I had one of those palpable, really important cinematic moments in my life. And as I said at the top of this, the head of the whole damn discussion, that happened. I can name the amount of times that's happened with me and the films. I mean, and I don't well up easy, but this film, so bias completely stated up front and at the close here, it affected me deeply, and I encourage anybody out there to go watch this film. You won't be disappointed. I thought it was fantastic.
All right. Sounds good. Welcome to segment two of Principal Photography. We are going to be talking about Roger Ebert, the legacy of the great film reviewer who just passed away last week. For me, Roger Ebert, I remember him from the from his TV show, from the Siskel and Ebert TV show. And, you know, we all know the two thumbs up, thumbs down and all that. And, you know, he's just such a part of movie culture and just popular culture over the last many decades. For me, I have a love-hate in a way with not just with him, but with reviewers in general. And I speak as someone who reviews movies from time to time. For a long time, I didn't respect the idea of film reviews and film critics in general. I thought they were, as a lot of people do, just kind of leeches on the creative work of others, you know, kind of useless. But Roger Ebert kind of changed my mind about that, because once he left the Sun-Times, and maybe a little before that, when he started getting into, for me, when he started getting into essays, he became, for me, as much an essayist and a film, almost a film theorist in some ways, over the years. And that, to me, was when it kind of turned. And that's when I realized that review can be something different. You can do a film review, and you can do it in a way that says more than, oh, this is good, this is bad, you know, the binary thumbs up, thumbs down. And that's for me, Roger Ebert. And we can talk more about that, of course. And, you know, I love a lot of his later stuff, and he'll be sorely missed, I think, in the film world. Well, what do you guys think?
You want to go, Chris? You want me to go?
Go for it.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm with Eric on this. I have a love-hate relationship with Roger Ebert. I have a love-hate relationship with one might call it the parasitic trait of reviewing in general, which clearly we all know that there's a finite amount of time and money in life, and the critic exists so that he or she can help make decisions for you based upon some set of criteria of good or bad and tastes and so on and so forth. I found myself so often agreeing with Roger Ebert over the years about so many things, but when I disagreed with him, I mean, I thought he was, you know, completely crazy about stuff sometimes. Specific examples I want to get into after Chris talks here, but he will be missed, and as Eric rightly says, as an essayist, few, you know, paralleled him, I think, in terms of just sheer prodigious output and the sort of personalization of film reviewing. He made it a very personal project, which endeared me towards him.
Yeah.
Chris?
I'm going to concur with both of you. I remember watching on Sunday nights. It was, you know, Ebert, Siskel and Ebert at the movies, and then after Siskel passed, it was Ebert and Roper at the movies. And you know, it seemed that with his essays, Roger kind of he bridged that gap between the film scholar and, you know, the popular viewer, you know, with some of his work. And he had a tremendous amount of foresight. And, you know, I have a couple of favorite reviews that he did that I think display a good bit of wisdom about the industry, about Hollywood, and about bridging the viewer and the film.
Yeah.
Eric?
So, well, what are your favorites? Why don't we do that? What are your favorite reviews, Chris?
I have two favorite reviews. The first one is a review he did for Jurassic Park, and don't get me wrong. I love Jurassic Park. I think it's a fun movie. It's way better than Carnosaur, which preceded it and attempted to kind of attempted to compete with Jurassic Park. But what Jurassic Park, you know, Spielberg gave us, you know, and Ebert talks about this, Spielberg gave us what we wanted. We, you know, it was a dinosaur movie, and it proceeds into this kind of monster movie, and I'm gonna quote from Roger Ebert here in his review, where he says, "Think back, quote, think back to another ambitious special effects picture from Spielberg, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That was a movie about the idea of visitors from outer space. It inspired us to think of what an awesome thing it would be. It was a movie that had faith in the intelligence and curiosity of the audience. I have the uneasy feeling that if Spielberg had made Close Encounters today, we would have seen the aliens in the first 10 minutes. And by the halfway mark, they'd be attacking Manhattan with death rays." And I think that was, you know, and that's from June of 1993. And I think we have seen that come to roost in Hollywood with this obsession with 3D special effects. I mean, look at Avatar. My biggest criticism of Avatar is, you know, it was Dances with Wolves with really cool looking Smurfs. Mm-hmm. And this obsession of 3D, and Disney is of course very, very guilty of this, where they, you know, they take Finding Nemo, a great movie on and of its own, and they force it into 3D, and there's this visual orgasm that the audiences need to get from seeing 3D and all of these wonderful effects pop out of us. And I think that's a really, you know, his review of Jurassic Park really hit that home and was telling as to what I think was going to happen in Hollywood.
It's interesting, Chris, because he has a one of my favorites of his is from January 23rd of 2011. He says, "Why 3D doesn't work and never will. Case closed. You know, and he has, well, and he talks about the merch and the science of 3D, but then he also has you know, his review of Jurassic Park 3D, where he says it's the best one, the best 3D conversion he's seen, right? And I agree with him on that, you know.
Right.
But right. Yeah, so that's great. Yeah, that's good. What about you, Nick? Do you have a favorite Ebert review?
You know, actually, I do. I mean, before I get into some of the aspects about Roger that kind of infuriated me over the years, and pretty much everybody I know, when I query them about Roger Ebert, they talk about this love-hate thing going on. So it just seems symptomatic of his name, you know, Roger Ebert. Conjures up images of agreement and disagreement, like you said, with this sort of like gladiatorial Caesar, thumb up or thumb down. Yeah. You know, movies are a bit more of a gray area than that. But I remember, you know, when you and I went and saw The Tree of Life, how provocative a film that was, and how divisive a film that was. When we saw it in Royal Oak, there was a sign that said, you know, refunds will not be given after the first 15 minutes. So that, remember that, Eric?
Yeah, awesome. That was
we
great.
Actually took pictures of that. But I immediately went home that day, and you know, this says something, that I went to Roger's website to actually look this up, because I trusted in and had a fondness for the personal aspect of his reviews. So I wanted to read a little bit from his review of Tree of Life. He writes in part, "Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life is a film of vast ambition and deep humility, attempting no less than to encompass all of existence and view it through the prism of a few infinitesimal lives. The only other film I've seen with this boldness of vision is Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, and it lacked Malick's fierce evocation of human feeling. There were once several directors who yearned to make no less than a masterpiece, but now there are only a few. Malick has stayed true to that hope ever since his first feature in 1973. One other teeny little part in there that I like, which illustrates the fact that Ebert would deeply personalize his reviews, as he writes, quote, "I don't know when a film has connected more immediately with my own personal experience. In uncanny ways, the central events of The Tree of Life reflect the time and place I lived in, and the boys in it are me. If I set out to make an autobiographical film and I had Malick's gift, it would look so much like this." I thought, gosh, you know, that kind of ties into this, our first segment tonight about the, you know, being a wallflower. I had a very similar response. So you can see how connected I am to this particular review.
Yeah, we can totally see that. Those are great quotes, and you know, from a great review about a great film, right? And you've hit on exactly what I like about Ebert when he does the personal and ties it to the film, you know. And I think that's something that a lot of reviewers are afraid to do. Maybe rightly so. Maybe they're not very good at it. Maybe it's not a good idea for a lot of people. But he, you know, he's drawing on decades of film viewing and film reviewing and of experience, you know. One of my favorites is when he talks about Werner Herzog's Aguirre, Wrath of God. You know, it's a pretty straight review, actually, and it goes very deeply into the film. But he says, you know, he talks about seeing it originally and then reviewing it, and he talks about how he doesn't feel like he saw the film the first time, and things like that. And I like when he revisits things like that, or when he used to revisit things like that, I suppose. But he's such a corpus of work that he leaves behind, and it's pretty amazing stuff, you know. And he was also, we should note, you know, he also was a champion of other reviewers. If you go to his site at RogerEbert.com, he finds bloggers and reviewers from different cultures, different countries, things like that, and showcases them on his blog. So he's also he was a big supporter of writing and reviewing in general. And just not to hog the whole thing, but he was certainly somebody who embraced technology. He was, you know, when he lost his power of speech, his blogging became much even more prolific, mm-hmm. and he was on Twitter all the time. All his social media stuff, you know, even a reviewer being on TV when he was on TV was kind of cutting edge. So somebody who was not afraid to take technology and do what he was doing with it.
You know, the thing that hasn't been mentioned much in the eulogies that I've come across, but like from people like Leonard Maltin and other things like that, is just how much of a part of film history Ebert was.
Oh, yeah.
There's, you know, two very famous things happened very early in his life, which I've talked about in class and other things, and that is, one, his very famous review of Night of the Living Dead, which he wrote for Reader's Digest. I mean, it had the inadvertent effect of actually bolstering box office. You know, when you get negative press, that's very often a byproduct of it. However, you know, it's a very famous piece that tied into the MPAA and that how the film was being, you know, played in matinees where children could go in and see it. And it was a very, very famous piece. And he became a big admirer of George Romero's, without question. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's his championing of Bonnie and Clyde when the rest of the world was, you know, well, not the rest of the world, but when some of the major media outlets of that time, Time, Newsweek, and so on, well, and of course, the famous firing of Bosley Crowther over the whole thing. Roger said, I don't know what film these troglodytes in their ivory towers are watching, but it's certainly not the Bonnie Clyde that I saw. And of course, his screenwriting cred for, you know, one of my idols, Russ Meyer, and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. But it ties into something else I wanted to say very briefly, because I know Chris wants to say something, and that's that he sort of became what he beheld in a certain regard, because just like Pauline Kael sort of eventually became the, you know, stiffened critic that was slowly losing touch with what was contemporary as she aged. And I bring this up because of Bonnie and Clyde, obviously, of which she was a major champion and op-edited for. Mm-hmm. Roger, I think, suffered from a case of his own ego. I think when At the Movies got huge, I think there became a sort of lackadaisical and approach to his reviewing that I witnessed growing up watching it in the 80s and tuning in and seeing... seeing him bandwagon and jump on certain bandwagons and dismiss films that I felt the younger Roger would have championed, not because he had matured or his worldview had moved on or anything like that, but that just because he'd gotten complacent and lazy. Mm. And it really bothered me, and I want to touch on that before we close out the podcast. I'll come back with some other opinions on that.
Well, I really liked Roger's, just his brutal honesty. And the one review when it comes to that is so funny, because I think his a lot of his bad reviews were almost as entertaining to read as those good ones. And when Pat Goldstein of the LA Times lambasted Rob Schneider for Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo, and said it was just a bad film. And then Rob Schneider comes back and takes out these full page ads saying, you haven't won the awards, you have never won a Pulitzer. And then Ebert came back and said, you know what, as somebody who has won a Pulitzer, I can confidently say, Rob Schneider, Mr. Schneider, your movie sucks. And that became the title of one of Roger's books, these famously bad reviews, and I think his reviews were just, they were entertaining to read, especially for these really, really, films that were just absolutely scraped the bottom of the barrel when it came to just absolute utter crap.
Yeah. So Nick, didn't you have a story you want to tell us about Ebert that you had?
I want to sort of, close out my comments on Roger by talking about, during this period in which I sort of became disenfranchised with him, he sort of bought into his own hype, into his own power as a critic, I thought. And, if I were to list some films that he gave negative reviews to initially, it'd be quite surprising. I tuned in back in 94 when Shawshank Redemption came out and watched both Roger and Gene give it marginal thumbs down. This is like nowhere to be found.
Yeah, that's a big one.
I mean, they've disavowed this original review, but I watched it being a huge fan of Stephen King and having read the novella from different seasons. I was dying to see their initial review before I went and saw it in the theater. But, for example, Shawshank Redemption, Fight Club, Straw Dogs, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, A Clockwork Orange, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Harold and Maude, Blue Velvet, a favorite of Eric's, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, all received negative reviews from Roger Ebert. I mean, he was certainly proven wrong, at least in the court of public opinion on many of these films. And I would say that this is probably really illustrated quite beautifully by the English academic Robin Wood, who writes in an essay called Neglected Nightmares. He sort of takes Ebert to task about inaccurately reporting about Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, a film that Roger was not fond of. So I'm just going to quote here from Robin Wood. He quotes, "If I begin with Last House on the Left, it is partly because it has achieved at least a certain underground notoriety and surfaced briefly in the pages of Film Common as one of Roger Ebert's guilty pleasures. I had better say that the guilty pleasures feature seems to me an entirely deplorable institution. If one feels guilt for a pleasure, isn't one bound to renounce either one or the other? Preferably, in most cases, the guilt, which is merely the product of the bourgeois elite that continues to vitiate so much a criticism. The attitude fostered is essentially evasive, including self-evasive, and anti-critical. Isn't this muck to watch, of course, because I'm really so superior to it, delicious. Ebert's guilty pleasure, which may be Last House's only recognition so far by professionally serious critics, is brief enough to quote in full." I'll spare everybody that here. But Robin Wood goes on to say that, "Pleasure or not, Ebert has plenty here to feel guilty about." And then he goes on to basically list a lot of things that Ebert gets wrong in his review. I mean, like, flat out just wrong. Not opinion-based, but fact-based. And he concludes by saying that Ebert's plot synopsis sets a new record in critical inaccuracy, combined with characteristic critic-as-superstar complacency, says less about him personally than about a general ambiance that encourages opinion-mongering, gossip, guilty pleasures, and other similar smart-assery, and as an inevitable corollary, actively discourages criticism and scholarship. And I couldn't agree more. If we're trying to, seek or know about a film, what does it do? What good does it do us to sit there and merely frame our responses through prisms of taste? And of course, Ebert was quite guilty of that from time to time.
I think all film critics, to a certain degree, are guilty of that. Whether it's Roger Ebert or Leonard Maltin or even the Detroit Free Press's Terry Lawson. I think filtering it through that area of taste, from a Bourdieu standpoint, all critics are guilty of that. And the critic's job is to look at films and then figure out what the public might want to see.
But then, of course, that brings up the question: what are the credentials of the critic? And that's the problem. Most critics these days are in the world of blogging and so on and so forth. I don't know whether I'm reading the reviews of a seventh grader who's, you know, or someone with a PhD. It's the lines are blurred.
True.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that that matters because, I mean, as you're reading, you – I mean, the whole thing about reviewing is you find somebody you trust, right, regardless of credential. I mean, I know a lot of people with PhDs who I would not listen to for film recommendations mm-hmm. because we just have different tastes because it does, unfortunately, come down to taste. And that for me is – It's a matter of how do you justify your taste or how do you articulate what is good or bad or worthwhile or whatever about a film. You know, we can go back to our last segment for that, right?
True.
In a certain way, you know, there's no taste. You can't take that out in a certain way when you're doing film criticism and film reviewing and they serve a particular function.
It does privilege, though. You know? That's the thing. I mean, Bourdieu was talking all about, like, class locations of taste.
Oh, sure.
And you know, yeah. a hierarchy.
Right.
Of,
right.
So, I mean, that certainly plays into it. I mean, that sort of, like, to some degree demeans low culture then.
Sure.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Of course, those who know me and know that I partially live in low culture, at least with regard to taste and my scholarship.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And I agree with you. There's a lot of shit out there now, right? But there was always a lot of shit out there.
Well, that's true.
Even when it was being
that's
published
true, yeah.
in newspapers and journals.
The anecdote I was that my friend, the author Ted Okuda in Chicago had sent me, and then Ted, we'll have Ted on the show in the upcoming, the near future, is Ted's a well-known author who lives in Chicago, and long time ago, used to work in Tower Records, when we still had Tower Records, and I'll quote from him, he said, "Ebert had a home in Lincoln Park, not far from the Tower Records I worked at, and he dropped by on a number of occasions. The one I remember best is when I was setting up a display of the latest edition of the Leonard Maltin Guide in the video department. As I was arranging the books, I heard a voice say, 'What's the matter? Don't you support the home team?' It was Ebert, smiling. He added, 'You know, I have a guidebook, too.' I told him I would gladly go to the book section and get copies of the book of his book as well. Then I got caught up helping a customer who had a laundry list of titles, checking on their availability. By the time I finished with that customer, Ebert had gone to the book section, got four or five copies of his book, which he autographed, and set up the display himself, and did a better job of it than I could have. I thanked him, and he chuckled. 'No problem,' he said. 'When you're a writer, you've got to go that extra mile to sell your book.'" That's the end of the anecdote. I think it's a very telling one. But then Ted had also told me that very recently in the Chicago Reader, which those of you who are familiar with Chicago, that there was a which is a very popular a newspaper. He said that Andrea Granville had recently written a piece about Roger, and it was called Ebert Off Camera, and it's sort of just a veteran Siskel and Ebert producer. Discussing her memories of the real Roger. So he kind of sent me that anecdote, but then also felt compelled to send me something that was also, you know, really gave a real essence of the guy, basically saying that he was a pretty interesting fellow off screen when no one was listening. He could be, you know.
Which we can definitely put in the show notes. We can put a link to that in the show notes for people to read as well, right? Yeah.
Sure, absolutely.
As well as those YouTube clips of him and Siskel arguing.
Outtakes, yes.
They're famous arguments.
So, yeah, definitely. Certainly there were many sides to the man, right? Just like there are to all of us, right?
Indeed.
But, you know.
He will be missed.
He will be missed.
His qualities as an essayist are they shine brightly in a world of mediocrity. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
Well, he helped to really define the idea of film criticism, and he paved the way for, you know, for a lot of other film critics and to kind of as this genre of journalism.
Yeah, I agree. He'll be missed. He's unparalleled, I think, today, and we'll see what happens in the future with film criticism for sure. Well, this has been a nice hour or so.
Yeah,
I mean,
talk about a successful launch. I'm thrilled to be here and
absolutely
be a part of this with you guys.
And so, thanks for listening to That's a Wrap, and that's a wrap for this is Eric Marshall for Chris Gullin and Nick Schlegel. That's a wrap.
That's a wrap.